It's good to be with you this week and have been looking forward to our time together. It's one of those things where after you've done this for a few years, you know what awaits you when you're coming to this week. You know how much work it's going to be and the late nights. So I guess it's a mixed emotion. As much as I enjoy being with everyone, I know that it's going to be a very full week. But the good thing is, as the week comes to a close, oh, it's just such an exhilarating feeling. We got through that. We accomplished so much. And I expect that this is going to be one of those weeks. New students, a lot of returning students. So that's nice. We kind of have both this year, and I've been looking forward to that aspect of it. But I'm excited as well about our study from the book of Hebrews and appreciate the elders and Harry working together to put this theme together as a part of our study. As we look at the book of Hebrews, it is a book that, as Harry was discussing in his first study this morning, there's a lot that we don't know about the book of Hebrews. Some have referred to it as the great riddle because we do not know for sure the author, the one who penned it. We certainly know that God is the one that gave us this epistle and all scripture given by inspiration of God, but we're not sure who penned it. We're not even sure as to the specific recipients of it. But what can be very clear to us is what the objective is in this particular epistle. And as we look at this book of Hebrews, one of the things that we're going to be looking at this morning is regarding the priesthood of Jesus in this particular epistle. As I said, we can be sure about the overall objective. The principal aim that I think that we find as we go through this book is overall an exhortation to faithfulness. And we'll see this exhortation introduced through a repeated expression, "let us." As a matter of fact, we'll find that probably nearly a dozen times as we go through this particular text. For instance, in Hebrews chapter 4 and in verse 1, "Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear, lest any of you seem to have come short of it." Then drop down to verse 11 in chapter 4. He says, "Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest." And in verse 14, he says, "Seeing then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession." And we can multiply that time and time again, that the writer of Hebrews continues to make that exhortation as "let us." He brings himself into that role of needing to be diligent and to be sure that that faithfulness is maintained. It appears that some of the Hebrews who had embraced Christianity, some who had confessed Christ, were at this point about ready to give that up and to turn back to the old ways of Judaism. And that would probably be a logical escape from the persecution that they were suffering. In their minds, at least, it would end that immediate persecution. But the writer of Hebrews is making an appeal to them that to turn back is to lose everything. To turn back, in reality, if they understand the old law, if they understand the types and the shadows and everything God intended for them to understand, from the high priest to the tabernacle to the sacrifices, that all of that is for nothing if they turn away from Christ and if they give up their confession. We also notice in this particular epistle the superiority of Christ being established in various ways. He is shown to be superior to the prophets in chapter 1 and verses 1 through 3, to be superior to the angels in chapter 1 in verses 4 through 14, superior to Moses, and you have already looked at some of these topics, but in Hebrews 3 and verses 1 through 6, but also superior to the Levitical priesthood, as we'll be looking at this morning. That's primarily found in chapter 7, about verses 1 through 28, and then he'll come back to it again in chapter 10. The book of Hebrews is difficult in some regards because the writer is making an argument and then he will divert, kind of what I refer to as chasing a rabbit. He introduces something as a part of his argument and then he needs to address what he introduced, but then he'll come back to that argument. Well, we've got to make sure that we stay with him as he goes through these segments like this. But overall, what he's showing us is that Christ and his new covenant and his kingdom is superior in every way. And in order to emphasize that, the author continually draws comparisons and contrasts as he goes through this particular letter. And we're going to see, as a result of that, a repeated expression over and over again, and that is the word better. As a matter of fact, this word better is used about 11 times as we go through this particular epistle. In Hebrews chapter 1 and in verse 4, he uses the word to express that Christ is better than the angels. In Hebrews 7 and in verse 19, that there is a better hope. In verse 22 of chapter 7, a better covenant. Again in chapter 8 and in verse 6, a better covenant. In chapter 9 and in verse 23, better sacrifices in this new covenant of Christ. In Hebrews 10 and verse 34, he speaks about a better possession. That clearly would have reference to what the Jews viewed as their possession as the people of God. And then in Hebrews 11 and verse 16, a better country. That again would address immediately what the Jews put so much stock and value in. And then in Hebrews 11:35, a better resurrection. Hebrews 11:40, a better promise. And in Hebrews 12 and verse 24, simply better things. And so it is not out of place to refer to this epistle as the better way of Christ. That epistle of better things, and therefore we have the assigned topics this week of Christ being better than the angels and being greater than Moses and a better priesthood, and as we'll talk about tomorrow or this evening, I believe, a better covenant, and then tomorrow better sacrifice, and then better promises on Wednesday. So we need to keep all of that in mind as we go through these studies to understand how they fit into the overall epistle that we're looking at here. As we look at this idea of a better priesthood, I want us to understand and to notice, look back in chapter 2. When we're thinking about the better priesthood of Christ, I want us to notice that Jesus is referred to as our high priest 11 times in this particular epistle. And the first time that we're introduced to this is in chapter 2 and in verse 17. Therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. So we're first introduced to him as our high priest, primarily on the basis of his qualifications, being merciful and being faithful. He's going to pick up in chapter 5 with why merciful is an important qualification for a high priest. But he's introducing that he is merciful and faithful. In chapter 2 and verse 17 and 18, he focuses in on the merciful aspect of Jesus. And that is that what makes him qualified in this way is that he was made like his brethren and in all things, and that he suffered being tempted, therefore he has that capacity that makes him a qualified high priest. But when he said that he's merciful and faithful, the writer diverts to the faithful aspect of him, which is a qualification of being a high priest. And chapter 3 then picks up with what makes Christ faithful. And there is the comparison and the contrast between Jesus and Moses, as I believe you've already studied. So he makes that case, then he begins to exhort them back to faithfulness, as we notice here in verse 12, beware. He warns them about the rebellion of Israel, as Jerry is teaching in one of the other classes. And as he addresses this, explaining how Jesus was faithful and leads to these Old Testament examples and exhortations that we have of the importance of faithfulness, then in chapter 4, he comes back in verse 14 to the high priesthood of Jesus and the merciful aspect. So understand that this letter is not necessarily written where, like in 1 Corinthians, you might have addressing marriage and then you're going to address issues regarding spiritual gifts and matters of fellowship. The writer of Hebrews is going to be making an overall application to their need for faithfulness. His argument is based on the superiority, the better things of Christ, and he's going to argue these various aspects of Christ. But there will be diversions in between, arguments that he will make. So we're introduced to the high priesthood of Christ in chapter 2, and one of the great things about it is the fact that he was made like us, that he suffered being tempted, and that qualifies him to be merciful. He comes back to that in chapter 4 and in verse 14, seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. There's another let us. There's an exhortation to faithfulness based on his mercy and compassion. Verse 15, for, here's the word that means, here's why. Because we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore, you have for, because, and then in verse 16, let us therefore. All of these arguments to hold fast our confession, and then in verse 16, to come boldly before his throne of grace, are based on his qualification as our high priest, that qualification being his mercy and compassion by virtue of his being made like his brethren. It was not an illusion. Jesus took on humanity fully. And to deny that in any way, shape, or form is to take away from his qualification as a high priest. So then he goes on in chapter 5 to continue this argument of his overall qualification of a high priest. And he begins to argue from the standpoint of the qualifications of the priests of the descendants of Aaron. And the fact that they were appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices, likewise Jesus was. That they didn't take that honor on themselves, but they were appointed as priests by God, likewise Jesus was. And this is when he introduces us to the relationship of Jesus and Melchizedek. While he does not go into it, he at least introduces it. Then, as we're familiar with, he has to stop in verse 11, because of their dullness of hearing, and rebuke that and exhort them to faithfulness even in their study and their application and their understanding of these Old Testament types and shadows. He goes through that in chapter 6. He picks it up again in chapter 6 in verse 20, or in verse 19, this hope we have is an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. There he is again. He diverted through the end of chapter 5 into chapter 6, exhorting them again to faithfulness in another area, and then he comes back to this high priesthood of Christ. So then we begin chapter 7 talking about the high priesthood of Christ. And so now, while he has made this point, introduced in chapter 2, come back to in chapter 4, and the first part of chapter 5, the fact that Jesus is a qualified high priest. The fact that he is compassionate, as high priest must be, and he finished making that point in chapter 5 and in verse 1, every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subject to weakness. Because of this, he is required, as for the people, so also for himself, to offer sacrifices for sin. And no man takes this honor to himself. So here are these basic qualifications of a high priest, and he's saying Jesus meets those. He was made like his brethren. Therefore, he suffered, he was tempted, he can have compassion on us, even though he didn't sin like the descendants of Aaron. He can still have compassion and deal gently, is one translation of what the high priest was to do. He can deal gently with us, as he makes the argument in chapter 4, 14 through 16, that he understands, that he has experienced these temptations. So he argues from the standpoint that Jesus is qualified. But when we get to chapter 7 is when he seems to really start making the argument that he is not just qualified, but that he is superior. That he is not just a qualified high priest, but that he is a better high priest, and that his priesthood is a better priesthood. I want us to notice some of the points that he makes then, beginning in chapter 7, that show us that Jesus is a better high priest, or that his priesthood is a better priesthood than that of the order of Aaron. First of all, he makes the argument from the standpoint of the order. Jesus was not of the order of the Levitical priests. He makes that very clear, beginning in about verse 12, for the priesthood being changed, of necessity there is also a change of the law, for he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no man has officiated at the altar. We use this as a great example of how silence does not authorize. The fact that God did not specifically forbid someone from the tribe of Judah from serving as a priest does not mean that it's okay for them to serve as a priest. As a matter of fact, they have no authority to serve as a priest. Jesus was not of the order of the Levitical priesthood, but he was of the order of Melchizedek. And I want you to notice how many times that we notice this. That idea is first introduced in chapter 5, in verse 6, chapter 5 and verse 6, as he says in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. The first time that this is brought to play. Now, it was spoken, certainly, back in the 110th Psalm. And those who were familiar with the Scriptures would have been familiar with that. But the Hebrew writer is now making his argument of superiority based on quoting that passage and making its application to Jesus. Again, in verse 10, he quotes it. In verse 10, called by God as high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. I want you to notice, as we talk about this order of Melchizedek, the Hebrew writer in verse 5 and in verse 6, he says, so also Christ did not glorify himself. In other words, Jesus didn't take on himself the priesthood. He didn't say, you know what, I think I want to be a priest. I'm the Son of God, I can do whatever I want, I want to be a priest. Jesus did not take that authority on himself. So he explains this, he says, but it was he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. He who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you? God, the Father. Well, what's important about that? Because he's the authority. Because he's the one that determines who is a priest and who is not a priest. He's the one who determined that Melchizedek would serve as priest. Melchizedek was appointed by God just as Aaron was appointed by God. And he's saying it is the same God who proclaimed the Christ or the Messiah, his son, that same God proclaimed the Christ high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, I realize that there are some who believe that this is making an argument that his high priesthood is tied to the fact or by virtue of the fact that he is the Son of God. I don't believe that that's the argument he's making. I think he's simply making that Jesus has the authoritative appointment as high priest because the same God who had the authority to proclaim the Christ as his son proclaimed him also as high priest. How would he proclaim him as high priest? Because he's according to the order of Melchizedek. What do we know about Melchizedek? Well, there's not much that we know. What we know is found in Genesis chapter 14 when Abram came back from his battle against the kings of the plain when he rescued Lot and his family and the people of the city and all of their goods. And the Bible tells us there in Genesis chapter 14, you'll notice beginning in verse 18, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand, and he gave him a tithe of all. That's pretty much all that we know from the Old Testament record. He's mentioned again, certainly in the 110th Psalm, as being the order of which Jesus would be our high priest. That's not a lot of information. Now, the Hebrew writer takes that information, and what we recognize is that he was king of Salem, priest of the Most High God. He blessed Abram, and Abram paid tithes to him. going to be some arguments made based upon that. But I want you to notice when we're thinking about this better order, the order of Melchizedek, as opposed to the order of Aaron and the Levitical priesthood, what we notice about Melchizedek is that he is both priest and king. King of Salem, priest of the Most High God. And I believe that the writer clearly is setting Melchizedek forth as typifying the qualities that are characteristic of the Messiah's kingdom. Notice in the 72nd Psalm, in the 72nd Psalm and in verse 7, in his days the righteous shall flourish and abundance of peace. Now when we read that Melchizedek was the king of Salem, Salem means peace. So he was the king of peace. And that he was also priest of the Most High God, as he is introduced here. And even in chapter 7, as the writer is introducing him, for this Melchizedek, verse 1 of chapter 7, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. So we see that he is a priest and a king. That's the same thing that we're going to recognize about Jesus and his kingdom in Isaiah 9 in verses 6 through 7. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. In Jeremiah 23 and in verse 5. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will raise to David a branch of righteousness. A king shall reign and prosper and execute judgment and righteousness in the earth. I want you to notice also in Zechariah 6. Zechariah 6 and verse 13. Yes, he shall build the temple of the Lord. He shall bear the glory and shall sit and rule on his throne. He shall be a priest on his throne. And the council of peace shall be between them both. We could go on and on. Romans 5 and in verse 1, we read about being at peace with God as a result of what Jesus did. Ephesians 2, 14, 15, 17. All of these are speaking to us about the fact that Jesus certainly is that King of righteousness, that Prince of Peace. There's no doubt that Melchizedek typifies this as priest and king. But he also makes the argument that it is a superior order because Abraham and, by implication, Levi paid tithes to him and received his blessing. Look back here in chapter 7 and in verse 4. He says, now consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave a tenth of his spoils. And indeed, those who are of the sons of Levi, who received the priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people, according to the law, that is, from their brethren, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Now, beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the greater. Here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witness that he lives. Even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak. For he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. That's an interesting argument, but it is an inspired argument. God, through the writer, is telling us that when we look at what Abram did by paying tithes, we understand, the Jews understood through the law that the lesser would pay tithes to the greater. And what he's saying is that Aaron, Levi, being a descendant of Abraham, was still in his loins. So when Abraham paid that tithe, then a descendant of Abraham is not going to be greater than Abraham. So if Abraham was lesser than Melchizedek, his descendants are going to be lesser than Melchizedek. The Aaronic priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, then is lesser. The order of Melchizedek is greater. Not just from the standpoint of paying tithes, but he also points out that Melchizedek blessed Abram. And therefore, once again, we see the greater blessing the lesser. All of these to make the point that the priesthood of, or the order of Melchizedek, is superior to that order of Christ and of, or of the Levitical priesthood. But I want you to notice also that he points out that there, that Melchizedek had no predecessor, no successor, no beginning or no end. That doesn't mean that Melchizedek was eternal, not in any way. But it is telling us that he is one who was without genealogy. There is no record of his genealogy. So his priesthood was not based upon who his father was or who his grandfather was, but it is rather based upon an appointment that was given by God. And so his position was not predicated on his known lineage. That was the case with the Levitical priesthood. Anyone who would serve as high priest, it would have to be based upon legal requirements. It would have to be based upon lineage. It would not be found in that person alone. The priesthood of Melchizedek was superior to the priesthood of Aaron because it was not on the basis of fleshly or earthly qualifications, but based on heavenly and spiritual grounds. Look in chapter 7 in verse 15 and verse 16. He says, "And it is yet far more evident if in the likeness of Melchizedek there arises another priest who has come not according to the law of fleshly commandment, but according to the power of an endless life." It's interesting, the argument that he makes there. It was not that he didn't have parents. It is that there is no record of that because his priesthood, the order of his priesthood, was not based upon that idea of genealogy. So as we see this fact that there is no successor, no beginning, or no end, it is not based upon legal requirements. I want you to notice also, as we think about the high priesthood, the better priesthood of Christ, that this argument from the order of Melchizedek, and certainly there's much more that could be said about that, but he goes on to another aspect of this that I want you to notice back here in chapter 5. In chapter 5, he says in verse 6, as he also says in another place, quoting from the psalmist, "You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." I want you to realize that not only is he of a better order than the Levitical priesthood, but he is of a better appointment. I say a better appointment because his appointment was not based upon fleshly law and genealogy, but it was based upon a vow. This is the argument that's made here in chapter 7, in beginning in verse 20. Notice in verse 20, he says, "And inasmuch as he was not made priest without an oath, for they," speaking about the Levitical priests, "have become priests without an oath, but he with an oath, by him who said to him, 'The Lord has sworn and will not relent,' you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." What is important about that? What is important about that? Well, the idea of this being an oath is tied into the order of Melchizedek. And it is, and it, what it's showing us is that it is based upon a vow. Notice in the 110th Psalm, or the quotation there is in the 110th Psalm and in verse 4. When he says that he has sworn and will not relent, I believe that this is the significance of the difference between the law and the vow. Look in chapter 7. We just read this in verse 12. He says, "For the priesthood being changed, of necessity there is also a change of the law." You know, laws can be changed, can't they? We have laws that are changed from time to time here in this country. In every country, there are laws that are changed. God's law changed. Obviously, we see that argument being made here. But you know what cannot change? A vow. And he seems to be making his argument based upon that contrast. We were talking in the beginning of this study that there are comparisons and contrasts being made. And I think that the contrast made here is the difference between a fleshly commandment, which can be annulled, it can be changed, and a vow which cannot. The Lord has sworn and will not relent. He makes the argument back in chapter 6 that God cannot lie. And that we can have confidence in the fact that when God makes a promise, it is going to come to pass. Verse 13, God made a promise to Abraham. He swore by himself. And then it says in verse 17 of chapter 6, God determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath that by two immutable, unchangeable things, it says that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation. So when he tells us that Jesus was made a priest by an oath, and he kind of uses it in a negative way here in verse 20, inasmuch as he was not made priest without an oath. Another way to say that was, he was made priest by means of an oath. The priests, the Levitical priests were not. They were made priests by a fleshly commandment, a law that could be annulled, that could be changed, and it was. His priesthood will not change. That makes it superior to that of the Levitical priests. And that what that tells us is of its eternal nature. It is never going to end. And that takes us to the third point that makes this priesthood better than the priesthood of the Levitical tribe. It is a better duration. What is its duration? It is forever. Look in chapter 7 and in verse 23. Chapter 7 and verse 23, also there were many priests because they were prevented by death from continuing. That's why there were many. You're going to see a contrast as he talks about the Levitical priesthood and the priesthood of Christ. And that contrast is between many and one. Obviously, one is superior to many. And he tells us why. He says, you know why there were many priests? That's not a good thing. Because they kept dying. He says in verse 24, but he, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. What a blessing. What a blessing, and how supreme. You have the priesthood of the Levitical priest, the Aaronic priesthood, where high priest after high priest had to be replaced because they died. And he's telling us here that this is different. He's a high priest forever. Go back to chapter 6 and verse 20 and see the same argument made. Remember, he introduces his priesthood being according to the order of Melchizedek, which, as far as the record goes, never ended. That's another way it typifies Christ. So he makes that argument in chapter 5, and then he has to divert to their faithfulness through chapter 6. He comes back to it in verse 20. He says, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. That forever and that order are tied together. His being made a priest by means of a vow rather than a law is tied to forever. But he says that he is a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now look at chapter 7 verse 1. What's the next word? For. The Greek word gar that means because. He is a high priest forever because. And he makes his argument based on the fact that Jesus is of the order of Melchizedek. Now I want you to notice in verse 2. In verse 3, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. There's the likeness. I want you to notice, he didn't say that Jesus was made like Melchizedek. He says Melchizedek was made like Jesus. He's the type. Jesus is the real image. Then in verse 8, here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives. Then in verse 16, who has come not according to the law of fleshly commandment, but according to the power of an endless life. And then verse 17, you are a priest forever. Verse 21, you are a priest forever. Verse 24, He continues forever and has an unchangeable priesthood. Verse 25, therefore He is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God because He always lives. And then in verse 28, He makes the argument again, for the law appoints as high priest men who have weakness, but the word of oath which came after the law appoints the Son who has been perfected forever. Here again, the argument based on oath, following the argument based on the order of Melchizedek, and it is bringing forth the superiority of His priesthood based on its duration. It is forever. As I said, what a blessing that this is. It never ends. Aaron and his successors died while Jesus lives forever. His efficacy is never going to fade. It gives us security in knowing that we're never going to have to endure another high priest that's not going to be as good as Jesus. Maybe you've had a really good boss or a supervisor at work, and then they take a new job or they retire. You get a new boss, a new supervisor, and they're just not as good. They're not as experienced. They just don't do things as well as your former boss. And that's always, you've got to make all these adjustments, and things are different. And for that matter, the Jews dealt with different men, with different weakness. The beauty of the priesthood of Christ is that it is forever. It will never change. And that gives me assurance in my relationship with Him. I never have to feel that insecurity, and this is a part of the argument that he's making. But he also argues that it is superior and better because it is of a better character, that is, sinless. Notice with me in chapter 7 and verse 26, for such a high priest was fitting for us. He's saying that Jesus and the high priesthood of Jesus, that it is forever, that it is endless, is fitting. It is what it was designed to be for us. In what way? He says, for such a high priest was fitting for us who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily as those high priests to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who have weakness, but the word of oath which came after the law appoints a Son who has been perfected forever. What's the advantage of that? Well, one of the beautiful things that we understand about this is a contrast. And I want you to think about the contrast between Jesus and the high priest in the day of the people that would be reading this, that would be the direct recipients of this epistle. Think about the corruption in the priesthood of their day in this century. Think about the corruption of the priesthood in the days of men like Ezra and Nehemiah. Even go back to Aaron himself at Mount Sinai when the people wanted him to make them a golden calf. You think about his transgression there. We see the weakness of Aaron. We see the corruption of other priests. And this was one of the challenges of a human priesthood. It was what it was supposed to be. It was a type. It was merely a shadow of what was better, of the better things to come. But that would have been so terribly frustrating. Because the high priest, and the significance of the high priest, is that he was that connection between God and his people. And the people were totally dependent on his efficacy, of his mediatorship, to take their sacrifices before God. What if he failed? What about when he was tainted? What about when he was polluted? What if there is corruption there? There was abundant evidence that God would not receive and would not accept that kind of sacrifice. It was very clear that that high priest had to cleanse himself. What if he did it? Certainly we see that God's death penalty with some of the priests, and God took care of that to some degree. But there had to be some insecurity on the part of the Jews that the person that would go before God for them had weaknesses just like they did. I wouldn't give a whole lot of confidence. And his whole argument here is, we have a better high priest. While he became like his brethren, while he was tempted and suffered and can have that compassion, here's the beautiful thing. He resisted sin fully, perfectly, and he was without sin. Therefore, he does not have to offer up sacrifices for himself. As a matter of fact, he offered one sacrifice once for all. There's that Greek word hapax, meaning of perpetual validity. He doesn't have to keep offering these sacrifices. He offered up that great sacrifice, which we'll talk about tomorrow morning. And that is forever done. He doesn't have to keep cleansing himself because he is holy, because he is harmless. I'll tell you another thing that this does for us and should have done for them as well. As we deal with humans, we recognize that there are going to be times when the best of us, when those that we are the closest to, will disappoint us. In our marriage relationship, a husband's going to disappoint his wife. No matter how much she may look up to him and how good a husband he may be, he's going to disappoint her at times. She's going to disappoint him. Parents will disappoint their children. Children disappoint their parents. Our best friend will disappoint us. Elders in the church will disappoint us. It's just the way of this life. And so there is that frustration and there is that level of insecurity that when maybe we're going to talk to one of the elders about something, are some of these foibles going to come out? Is this going to be a bad time? Is that weakness going to be glaring at this particular time? We never have to be concerned about that with Jesus. Not because he had some incapacity to sin. It's because he resisted it. And now he's been perfected. And he is ever living to make intercession for us. I don't have to worry about a temper that maybe lashes out and this is a bad time. I don't have to worry about there being some corruption in that person's life and so maybe it taints their judgment or their decisions on things. Jesus and his character is absolutely perfect. 1 Peter chapter 2, he tells us there in verse 22 regarding his faithfulness, and this was a part of the argument that was made in chapter 3 and his faithfulness. But in 1 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 22, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. Holy and harmless, Jesus is that one who is sinless, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens. When it says that he's separate from sinners, it's not saying that he is not able to connect with us. Oh, this is one of the beautiful things we see about Jesus being from the city of Nazareth. He's not too good. He's not above anyone, no matter where we come from. That's why we sing the song, Just As I Am. We can come to him. We can approach him. And he can sympathize with us and deal gently with us. It doesn't mean because he's done what we did, but because he's experienced those temptations and because he considers us brethren. John chapter 5. Some of the most beautiful words we read from Jesus is that he calls us his friends. That's significant, and it's something that I'm not sure that I've always connected with. And that doesn't mean that we lose our reverence for our Lord Jesus. But what it does mean is that he intends for us to draw near and that we can make that connection. And even though he hasn't done what we've done, he can sympathize and deal gently with us. He's separate from sinners in his character, in his purity, and I'm so thankful that he is and that he was. But at the same time, he's not ashamed to call us his brethren. Yes, his high priesthood is superior in its character, but then also it is better in its location. Notice with me in chapter 9, Hebrews chapter 9. He says in verse 11, but Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation. Look over in chapter 9, look in verse 24. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Notice that contrast. The contrast between the Levitical priesthood, who went into that tabernacle made of animal skins, and their service was done in the holy place, and then the high priest went once a year into the Holy of Holies to make that atonement for the people. But what we're seeing here is that this was clearly not the greatest that was intended. This was not the true tabernacle. He speaks here in chapter 9 and verse 11 about a greater and more perfect tabernacle. Notice he said, not made with hands. What is that? Look back in chapter 8. In chapter 8, notice beginning in verse 1, now this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Verse 2, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. Now, drop on down and notice in verse 5. Speaking about the Levitical priests, he says, who served the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mount. Notice the contrast and the comparison. True tabernacle versus copy and shadow. Made with hands, in contrast with not made with hands. What he's telling us is that the location, that the tabernacle that Jesus serves in is far superior to that that Aaron served in. In chapter 9 and in verse 8, he says, the Holy Spirit, indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all. Now, remember, he's been explaining to us about those gifts and sacrifices offered under the first covenant. And he says in verse 8, the Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing. It was not made manifest. That was not the holiest of all. It was merely a type. It was merely a shadow. Then notice in verse 11, but Christ came as the high priest of the good things to come. Some translations say the good things that have come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle. So his point is that the Levitical priests served in the lesser tabernacle. What was lesser about it? It was made with hands. It was earthly. Those skins had to be replaced. Of course, eventually David wanted to build a more grand place for God's dwelling place. And I think that to some degree God was explaining to David, you're missing the point. I don't dwell here on earth in the first place. You can make me a temple. But even Solomon understood, we've done all of this, but God does not dwell in temples made with men's hands. The way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, but it has been now. And that's where Jesus serves in that greater tabernacle. And that makes his high priesthood greater because Aaron could never truly go into the presence of God. He could only provide for us a shadow of what the true, the real, the great high priest would do. When he, look back in chapter 4, verse 14, when he passed through the heavens. See that in verse 14? Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. He says, don't throw this one away. You better hold on to this. Aaron never went there. Not one of his sons ever went there. But Jesus, he didn't pass through from the holy place to the most holy place in the tabernacle. He didn't pass through from the holy place to the most holy place in the temple of Solomon. He passed through the heavens. And he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. You know what that means? That means Look back here in chapter 4 in verse 14, 15, and 16. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize. Verse 16, let us therefore do what? Come boldly to the throne of grace and find grace to help in time of need. Aaron could bring the sacrifice for the people, bring it before God. Jesus has entered into that heavenly place, and he says, join me. Through me, you can enter into this heavenly place. He provides a way and makes it possible for us to draw near to God. The Israelites could not draw near in that same way. But through the high priesthood of Jesus, we can draw near to God, and as he says, find grace to help in time of need. Again, I want to emphasize that the overall point of this superior priesthood of Jesus is, number one, so that they would maintain their faithfulness, so that they would hold fast to their confession, so that they would hold fast to Christ and not give that up. And one of the arguments that's being made here that is so important, and it's one that we will forever need, is that in those times when we are tempted to let go, in those times when it feels overwhelming to hold on to Christ in the midst of that storm, he's telling us that he has provided the help that we need to get through anything and everything. For the recipients of this epistle, even in that persecution of the Jewish unbelievers, he says, don't throw Christ away. Instead, understand that he makes it possible for you to find grace to help in your time of need. How blessed they were, how blessed we are that we have that ability. You know, one other thing as we close that we notice about the high priesthood of Christ is that it also was superior in that it was a better ministry. Look in chapter 8 and in verse 6. He says, but now he has obtained a more excellent ministry. What is that ministry? Well, the Levitical priesthood, their ministry was to serve in that tabernacle. Their ministry was in all of their work on behalf of the people and their relationship with God. But he says that Christ has received a better ministry. In what way? In that he is the mediator of a better covenant. I believe that we'll be studying about that this evening, which was established on better promises. This better ministry is a ministry of a, because the priests administered the covenant, the law, and they administered the sacrifices. So this ministry is a better ministry because it is a better covenant and it is better sacrifice. We'll talk about the better sacrifice tomorrow. So let us be thankful. Let us give praise to God as we study this book of Hebrews to see the beautiful aspect of the high priesthood of Christ. What's the takeaway from this? Certainly we want to understand the context and its application and all these things. But if we do not make its application in our daily life and to understand, and I realize that I would expect most of us not growing up Jews, that it is hard for us to fully relate to the Jewish reception of this epistle and how significant the priesthood of Aaron was to them, how significant that tabernacle was and those sacrifices were. What we've got to understand is how significant the high priesthood of Christ is to us in our everyday life, and to come boldly before his throne of grace, to understand that it will never change, to understand that he is absolutely pure and we can trust every motive, every decision, every work of God, every work of Christ in our life, and that he is compassionate, and that he will deal gently with us. I need that. no matter how long I live, I've realized that I need to know that regardless of how much I may loathe myself, how much I may be frustrated with myself and my failures, He will deal gently with me. That gives me confidence. Instead of waiting in my transgressions, it gives me the confidence to rush to Him and to come boldly before that throne of grace. And I hope it does you too. Thanks be to God. I appreciate your kind attention, and we'll continue our